Welcome back to the program. Almost as much as our fingerprints or our relationship, we each seem to have very individualized taste profile. We might like our coffee black while our partners or colleagues like it with cream and sugar. We may love broccoli and hate sweets, just the opposite of others. How does this profile develop? Can we refine it, change it, and even get more enjoyment out of food? Finally, what's the link between how food tastes and how it sometimes leads to problems? We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Barb Stuckey. She's been a professional food developer for 15 years. She leads the marketing and sales functions at Mattson North America, the largest developer of new foods and beverages. It is my pleasure to welcome Barb Stuckey here to talk about her new work, Taste, What You're Missing, The Passionate Eater's Guide to Why Good Food Tastes Good. Barb Stuckey, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. What have we learned scientifically about why individual taste is often so varied?
Well, we know that there are a number of factors that go into what I call your taster type. And, of course, one of the things that everyone knows pretty well, it's pretty obvious, is that the culture, your culture, how you're raised, where you were raised affects it. But we know a lot about how culture influences our likes and dislikes. So what I've done in Taste What You're Missing is kind of filled in the picture with what we don't know a whole lot about. And that is that our specific taster type is made up of three things that really influence it. The first is your anatomy. The second is your genetics. And the third is your history, your medical history. And so just very quickly, the anatomy that I'm talking about, of course, is the anatomy of your tongue. And believe it or not, each one of us has a different density of taste buds on our tongue. So not all tongues are created equal. And there's an exercise in the book that you can do that'll actually help you be able to count the taste buds on your tongue. You can do it just with simple blue food coloring, dye your tongue blue, the taste buds pop out a little bit, and then you're able to count them in a certain area. And it turns out that the denser packed your tongue is with taste buds, the more intensely you experience food. So that means that some of us might taste something as incredibly bitter because of the density of taste buds on our tongue. And that same food might appear to someone else as, not so bitter.
How then do we arrive at some kind of objective standard for food? You know, we sit up here in the wine country where we've got an awful lot of what is claimed to be really excellent food, which may not taste so good to some people given all of these factors, culture, anatomy, and genetics.
Right, exactly. Well, luckily, the bulk of the population, about 50% of us, fall in this middle range. So in the middle range of taste bud density. And that means that, you know, wherever you fall in the middle of that middle range, you've got a lot of people that have about the same ability to taste as well. Now, of course, taste is just one of the senses that we use to experience food. So when I talk about your taster type, I'm not talking about your smell type or your sight type or your hearing type or your texture type. And all of those things are different from person to person. And so really, we all do live in our own personal sensory world.
Of course, the question then is how close any of us are to, you know, Michael Bauer, for example.
Right. I always thought that it would be a good thing to have food critics and wine critics actually take one of these tests, and I can give them a very quick genetic test that would tell me whether or not they fall into this range of extremely sensitive tasters. Although that may not be the best place for a critic to fall. Of course, if the critic wants to represent the bulk of the population, it would be better that a food critic or a wine critic would fall in that middle range. And for example, let me give you a personal example. My fiance happens to be what we call a super taster, or in the book I use the term hyper taster, because to me it just sounds like a lot less like a superhero. And really, it's not about being better or worse. It's just about having more taste buds. So he is one of these hyper tasters. And as a result, go back to the wine country example you use, he simply cannot enjoy big red wines. He cannot handle the tannin. He cannot handle the bitterness. He cannot handle the sweetness of a really lovely sweet white wine. And so as a result, he tends to kind of veer towards the middle, much more mild, much more mellow wine. So he drinks Pinot Noirs, for example, and, you know, he likes soft Merlots. So, you know, it's not necessarily a great thing that you are endowed with this extra density of taste buds.
Mm-hmm. When people are creating foods in the laboratory, in some respects, much of what you do, how do you then account for these variations?
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's for a large company, and we do work for some of the largest multinational food companies, and we're really trying to hit that middle mainstream American, we will do lots and lots of consumer testing of our prototypes as we're developing them here in the lab. And we will eventually settle on some taste profile that fits the vast majority of consumers. Of course, we're never going to please everyone with a single prototype or a single food. But these days, things have changed quite a bit. And even the big marketers, the Krafts, the General Mills, the Starbucks, the McDonald's of the world, have started to market to more niche groups. And as a result, they are able to closer target what they're developing for a specific taste profile, a specific ethnic group, a specific demographic in one way, shape, or form.
Can an individual change or alter their taste profile?
Unfortunately, no. The taste anatomy and our taste genetics are what we're born with, and for the most part, it sticks with us through life. And that's a good thing. Taste is a very, very stable and robust sense. Smell, on the other hand, is the one sense that seems to decline much more than taste as we age. And so as people age, they tend to say that, you know, the food doesn't taste as good. I don't get as much taste from the food. Well, in fact, they probably do get the same amount of taste from the food. And the easy way to test that would be to have someone that's making this complaint simply disable their sense of smell mm-hmm. by plugging their nose. And it's likely that they can taste the food just fine. What is probably happening is that their sense of smell is declining slightly. But in answer to your question about can we develop our taste buds or do they change, one of the things that I'm trying to explain to people in the book is that just like anything that you want to get good at, whether it's golf, whether it's piano, whatever art, painting, whatever it is that you want to get good at, you practice. And so with practice and understanding, I believe that you can train yourself to be a better taster and smeller and texture analyzer. And with the understanding and the training, you can get more sensory pleasure from the food you're already eating.
For example, and I think we probably all know people like this, that maybe have enjoyed a lot of sweet foods or a lot of fat or salt or whatever, and because of health reasons or things that have happened in their lives, they've had to dramatically change their diet. And it was difficult and painful at first. But after a while, in some cases, they got used to it and, in fact, began to enjoy the foods that they eschewed previously.
Yes, and that's a great point. I write about a case study in my book, a woman who had to do exactly what you're saying. She was diagnosed with a medical disorder that made her have to practically give up any added sodium in her diet. So she could no longer enjoy anything that was salted or had a high level of salt in it. And boy, she really missed it at first. And she really felt like her life was going to change. She was having trouble even eating out because everything on a restaurant menu is so loaded with sodium. Mm-hmm. She inevitably figured it out. And what she told me is that once she started getting used to it, and of course it takes a long time to get used to it, if you're trying to change your diet, my suggestion is to not go from heavily salted foods overnight to unsalted foods, but to slowly taper off of the salt or taper off the sugar. But what this woman told me is that once she did get used to the flavor of food without all the salt, that she saw things in a new light. The sweetness and the crunch of a red bell pepper to her became this amazingly sweet vegetal experience that she really hadn't noticed before because most of what she was eating was hidden with so much salt.
The other part of it is the way in which we eat today in our cars, on the go, rarely taking time, and how that process impacts how food tastes.
Yes. Well, I have a saying that I say, friends don't let friends eat and drive. I mean, there is nothing worse for getting enjoyment out of food than distracting your mind with a task that requires a lot of attention, like driving. So it's likely that when you try to eat and drive, that you are doing both of those activities less well. So what I really believe we need to do in this country is to really respect the meal occasion, respect the food, and to pay attention to it and listen to what it has to say to you sonically, and to look at it and see what it has to give you in terms of visual appeal, and take all of the sensory input from the food. Sit down, turn off the radio. Sorry, don't turn off the radio. Close the book, close the magazine, turn off the TV. Pay attention to the food. And what you're going to do when you do that is you're going to see things, hear things, feel things, taste things, smell things that you wouldn't do otherwise when you're occupying your mind.
Is that true, though, only if we're eating good quality food? If we're eating processed food and junk, does it matter?
Well, I hope that what this does for people is build into them an appreciation for what good food tastes like. And good food tastes fresh. It tastes balanced. It's not overly salty. It's not overly fatty. And so, you know, I try not to be judgmental about what people are eating. There are certainly good processed foods. There are artisanal, beautiful, local processed foods that we all we love. But what I really hope is that with this appreciation of the sensory enjoyment that food gives us, that people will learn to eat better food. Just like in wine tasting, back to the wine country analogy, the more you learn about wine, the more wine tasting courses you take, the better wine you seek out. And so what I hope this book is, it's like taking a wine tasting course, but for food. And so with the understanding, you will seek out better food. And I have found that to be the case in my own life.
What about, you talk about the sensory aspect. One of the things you detail in the book is the value of sight with respect to food, even more than smell.
Yes. Yes, and people are shocked at how easily they can be fooled. I do a number of tasting exercises for my clients here at Matson, and I can easily fool them with just a touch of food coloring. And of course, there are a number of famous examples in the wine industry where you can take two glasses of white wine, put a drop of red food coloring in one of them so that it looks like a red wine, and then serve it to people. And not just people that, you know, drink wine casually, but wine professionals, food professionals, chefs, and they will perceive the wine as a red wine. They will taste tannin, they will taste bitterness, they will taste red fruits, leather, all of the characteristics that we normally assign to red wine, simply because their eyes dominated the sensory experience and influenced what they're tasting and smelling. And I have multiple examples of this in the book. There is just example after example of how we let our sense of sight fool us.
Of course, that has a lot to do with the presentation of food.
Yes, it's critically important. And so many of the good restaurants that we have access here to in the Bay Area take incredible time and effort in plating the food so that it really pleases you visually. And, you know, I don't think you have to eat at a great, expensive restaurant to take that pleasure. Just simply start to appreciate it. Appreciate the color differences, the color contrasts, the difference in shade, and try to understand what that visual information is communicating to you. Sometimes it communicates to us freshness, or it communicates to us what the texture or the taste is going to be like. And so, you know, I think we really take for granted how much information we get from the food visuals.
Talk a little bit about the cultural influences and the evolutionary influences, because arguably the kind of foods that any of us might have liked 20, 30 years ago are not necessarily the same as what we enjoy today.
Yes, I mean, certainly culture has changed tremendously in the last 20, 30 years, and largely driven by immigration and our influence and our exposure to ethnic cultures. Of course, we have a wonderful Latino culture in California that we're exposed to, wonderful Asian cultures, and with these cultures and these immigrants comes their food culture. And so we start to get exposed to them and become familiar with their flavors. And as a result, we tend to see even those foods that we were eating 20 or 30 years ago changing. So we tend to be seeking out bolder flavors today. And we see this across every category in the grocery store and every restaurant segment. Consumers are just looking for more intense experiences, whether it be through their beverages with, you know, bolder coffees that are darker roasted, or whether it be the condiments that they're using that they're buying at the grocery store. They want them to be bolder, have more spicy level of heat. And so as a result of a lot of influences, we're tending to seek out bolder foods these days.
What's the consequence of that as we keep pushing that envelope? Do things start to have less subtlety in their taste?
Well, yeah, you could argue that. I mean, yes, I think there is a lot to be said for subtlety. But in order to appreciate subtlety, you really need to pay attention. And as you mentioned earlier, in this culture, we tend to gloss over a lot of what we're eating. We really don't pay it the proper respect. And so as a result, subtle food in this culture doesn't really get its due. In fact, I talked to a restaurateur in San Francisco, Craig Stoll, who runs the wonderful Delfina restaurants. And he talked about how he was trying to bring authentic flavors to his restaurant, but that the authentic Italian flavors that he was trying to do from Italy, he had to take them. He said, I'm bringing them from Italy, and they're subtle, but at my restaurant, I have to push subtle a little bit further just to please the American palate, which demands a little bit more boldness than the Italian palate, for example.
What do we learn from looking at the taste profile of children and the way they evolve over time?
Well, it can be an exercise in frustration, that's for sure. But I one of the things that I hope my book does is gives parents and grandparents taste empathy. And by that I mean the understanding that children are really not trying to make your life difficult, that they are just reacting to their biology. And that is that they are born to seek out things that are very sweet and to reject things that are bitter. And that is a protective mechanism. Sweet foods indicate calories, which is what we need to survive. Of course, in this today's world, we generally have too many calories at our disposal versus too few. But bitter, on the other hand, it usually indicates some sort of medicinal quality in the food. And so for developing children's digestive and immune systems, anything that's bitter could be dangerous to them. And of course, poisons, for the most part, poisons taste bitter. And so when children reject bitter foods like Brussels sprouts or broccoli, it's not that they're just trying to be difficult. It's that their biology is telling them, hey, wait a second, there's something going on here that could be dangerous to my little person immune system.
But what about the degree to which culture overtakes biology here? I mean, you watch French children, for example, and they will eat up foods that American kids won't touch.
Well, yes, and that's partly because their parents won't let them get away with not
right.
eating them. Yes, and yes, there are quite a few good books out there about how the parenting of other ethnicities and other cultures really influences the way that children eat. And certainly, I am not a parent. I don't have children, so I can't, from my glass house, I cannot throw stones at parents. But certainly, the more you can expose your children to intense flavors and bitter flavors, the more likely they will accept them. Now, what's interesting about that is that it doesn't start when your kids start eating food. It starts in the womb. And there is some wonderful research that was done at the Monell Chemical Senses Center, which proved that flavors transfer from the mother who is pregnant or nursing or both, and those flavors that she's eating in her diet, and the research was done with carrots, that carrot flavor transferred to the baby. And when they tested the babies after they were born or after they were breastfed while the mother was eating carrots, those babies accepted carrots versus children from mothers who didn't eat carrots when they were pregnant or nursing. And so what we know is that whatever the mother eats when she's pregnant or nursing is going to influence the taste preferences of her children. So it's incredibly important for moms to start thinking about what they want their children to eat and eat that way when they're pregnant.
What about texture, and what role does that play in the way we taste foods?
Oh, it's huge. It's tremendously important. In fact, I have a chapter on the book in the book on texture, and one of the people that I interview in the chapter was born without a sense of taste or smell. We can't possibly imagine that, but that's the way he was born, and so he doesn't know anything otherwise. And his entire experience of flavor, which is the combination of taste, smell, and texture, his entire experience of flavor is texture. And he talks about texture in a very interesting and unique way. He talks about texture in that good food has good texture. And good texture, of course, means appropriate texture for what you're expecting. A nice degree of texture contrast. Texture that makes sound, that gives us some kind of sonic response so that we can get some of the other sensory pleasure from sound. And so texture turns out to be incredibly important to us.
Talk a little bit about the natural genetic instinct we have to go towards, once we're not kids anymore, things that are fatty or things that are sweet or salty.
Sure. Well, each one of us is quite different in the way that we perceive through our senses, but also each one of us is quite different in terms of our genetics. So you can't really make blanket statements about people. But what we do know is that we used to, as a culture, we used to have to work very, very hard for our food. We would have to hunt animals and forage for fruits and vegetables. And then once we had those animals and fruits and vegetables, we had to skin them and butcher them and cook them and mill them. And, we had to go to great extremes to feed ourselves. And so as a result, we are wired to seek out sweet foods, which are easy sources of calorie, easy to digest, quick sources of energy, to seek out salty foods, because who knows when your next salty meal is going to come from. And since we don't have a way to store sodium in our body, it's important that we get enough sodium so we crave it. And to seek out fat, because fat is the most dense source of calories that we can eat. And so we're wired this way, and unfortunately, evolution moves very, very slowly. And so now we live in this environment of easy access to calories, easy access to fat, easy access to sodium, and yet evolution hasn't caught up with us. And so as a result, we're eating way too much of all of those things. And of course, they have terrible ramifications for our health.
Of course, there's the consumer side of that. Because we have this natural inclination to those things, food manufacturers go out of their way to give us those things.
Yes, and some to an egregious degree, I would agree. Although the food industry, and I can speak from experience because this is what I do for a living, the food industry is seeing the light. They're really changing their tune and trying to create foods that have less sugar, less sodium, less fat, and more of the beneficial nutrients, more whole grains, more fruits and vegetables. And so I think, the food industry is really trying to change from delivering empty calories to delivering delicious foods that are not just empty calories. And I know this because I'm formulating a lot of them. We work for some of the largest food companies in the world, and we are working on, I would say, a majority of the projects that we're working on are what we call better for you versions of foods that we love.
What's changed? Why do you think the food industry is suddenly paying attention to this?
Well, I mean, you can't ignore the health crises that we have in this country, the degrees, the rising rates of obesity and diabetes and heart disease. And, diet is not the only thing that's responsible for it. Certainly, we are much less active than we used to be, and some of us are genetically prone to these diseases, but certainly food plays a role. And part of the problems with our culture is that we're so incredibly busy just trying to carve out a living, trying to keep our kids fed, trying to keep our jobs, that we have so little time and we devote so little time to cooking that we end up sacrificing health for convenience. And I really hope that the ball, and I think the ball is moving in the right direction, though.
Barb Stuckey, her book is Taste What You're Missing, The Passionate Eater's Guide to Why Good Food Tastes Good. Barb, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.